Dear Sam Harris and Jill Bolt Taylor, hello, my name is Dan Latner. I'm some dude from Canada, and I'm writing to see if you can help me figure out what to do with this story. It's more than I can cover in one letter, so I'll just try to give you a bird's eye view today. Here are the basics. Back in 2016, I was working as an international tour guide, and I had a lot of time to listen to podcasts on airplanes and bus rides. I kept hearing neuroscientists talk about how meditation is good for your brain, so I decided to give it a shot, and I downloaded the Headspace app. I liked how meditating made me feel, so the next year I signed up for a 10-day Vipassana retreat. I can't remember if I even knew it was a Buddhist thing when I showed up, and I was a bit weirded out when the teacher, S.N. Goenka, told us via video recording that some people meditate for focus and mood and general brain health, and some people meditate for spiritual practice. He said not to worry if we weren't into spirituality, that it would still have positive effects, and I thought, great, because spirituality doesn't exist. He also told us that you could have pleasant experiences, and that whatever happens, we should remain equanimous. I didn't feel anything weird, so there wasn't much to remain equanimous about. I liked it, though. I felt more focused and calm when I finished the course, so I kept meditating, and I even went back the next year to volunteer in the kitchen. Flash forward to the pandemic. I was living alone in a city called Guelph in Ontario, and I decided to use lockdown as an opportunity to get my shit together. So, you know, I worked out and journaled and meditated and tried to eat healthy. And in June 2020, I read a book called Scattered Minds, The Origins and Healing of Attention Deficit Disorder by a doctor named Gabor Mate, and it completely blew my mind. I always knew I was a bit quirky, but I never looked into psychology, so there was a lot of low-hanging fruit. I had some basic psychological breakthroughs and realizations which felt very profound to me, but were par for the course for this kind of thing. A few weeks after that, on July 9th, 2020, I was hanging out with my friend in her backyard, middle of the day, sober, and all of a sudden I started having a very interesting and enjoyable subjective experience. It felt kind of like a high or a deja vu. It's hard to describe the quality of the experience, but it definitely felt like a good thing. And I started having ideas like, wow, existence exists. That is amazing. And, oh, good vibes are good because they feel good. And I'm not Dan Latner. I'm a dang lantern, and my job is to glow as brightly as I can and help other people light up too. I had a great afternoon and evening, just kind of loving everything and feeling awesome. And the next morning, I had a little think, and I decided I should try to tell a neuroscientist what was happening to see if they wanted to scan my brain. Like the psychological breakthroughs, it was very impressive to me, but I didn't think I was the only person who ever felt this way. I knew it was one of those pleasant experiences Goenka talked about. I didn't think I had some special message, and I wasn't trying to save the world or anything like that. My thoughts were more along the lines of, it's 2020, TED Talks exist, I've heard neuroscientists talk about measuring interesting states in monks' brains, so I should report this. To me, it felt like how if I found a dinosaur skull, I'd try to tell a museum. So I've since talked with two medical doctors who claim to be fully awakened, whatever that means, and they both told me that trying to report it was very naive. I don't know about that. The way I see it, I just didn't know anything about the mental health system because I'd never dealt with it before. I basically learned everything I knew about psychology in the past few weeks from this Gabor Mate, who I now understand is kind of progressive, but I didn't know that at the time. And I learned most of what I know about neuroscience from podcasts. So I guess I just figured the doctors would have heard the same podcasts as me. I didn't run to the hospital and say, I'm getting enlightened, study me. No, I knew I had to be cautious. I saw how any of the names I knew for a subjective experience like that could potentially be problematic, and also I was kind of buzzy at the time. I was altered, you know? It was an altered state, but I was on top of it. Now I understood why Goenka told us to remain equanimous. I feel like I'm being disrespectful if I compare it to tripping, but it was a lot like tripping. Anyway, I was altered, but I was fine. I was safe and managing okay. And I thought the best way to make sure that nobody thought I was nuts would be to get some resources from reputable scientists to show I was framing it in a scientifically appropriate context. And you two were the scientists I thought of. Jill, JBT, I remember exactly where I was the first time I heard your story. I was in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, listening to one of those TED Talk compilations, and your My Stroke of Insight story completely dazzled me. Luckily for me, I had your book on my shelf. I hadn't read it yet, at the time that this was all going on, but a few months before this story happened, I found it on one of those free library boxes on people's lawns. So I flipped through, and I saw that whatever I was feeling felt like what you described when you had your stroke. Here's a quote. My entire self-concept shifted as I no longer perceived myself as a single, a solid, an entity with boundaries that separated me from the entities around it. I understood that at the most elementary level, I am a fluid. Of course I am a fluid. Everything around us, about us, among us, within us, and between us is made up of atoms and molecules vibrating in space. Although the ego center of our language center prefers defining ourself as individual and solid, most of us are aware that we are made up of trillions of cells, gallons of water, and ultimately everything about us exists in a constant and dynamic state of activity. My left hemisphere had been trained to perceive myself as a solid, separate from others. Now, released from that restrictive circuitry, my right hemisphere relished in its attachment to the eternal flow. I was no longer isolated and alone. My soul was as big as the universe and frolicked with glee in a boundless sea. End quote. So I thought, great, Jill Bolt Taylor is a world-famous neuroanatomist. She's got one of the top 25 most watched TED Talks. She's got a degree from Harvard. She's been on Oprah. This is a high-quality resource. If I show this to nurses and doctors, they'll definitely know what I'm talking about. Sam, I can't remember when or where I first heard about you, but I always thought you were cool on podcasts, and a few years before this story I'm telling you now happened, I tried to read your book Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. But I couldn't get past the first chapter. It just didn't click. When this thing happened, though, I thought, oh dang, this is one of Sam Harris's spiritual experiences for smart people. I didn't have your book, so I downloaded a copy. I'm sorry. I will buy you a sandwich one day. In Waking Up, you write, I can say that the true goal of meditation is more profound than most people realize, and it does, in fact, encompass many of the experiences that traditional mystics claim for themselves. It is quite possible to lose one's sense of being a separate self and to experience a kind of boundless, open awareness, to feel, in other words, at one with the cosmos. End quote. Lose one's sense of a separate self. Those are tiny words to describe a great big feeling. It wasn't a metaphor like feeling connected to the forest. It was like my me was gone for a little bit. That's what it felt like. So anyway, I saw that and I thought, great. Sam Harris is a 5-times New York Times best-selling author. He has a degree in philosophy from Stanford and a PhD in neuroscience from UCLA. He's meditated for over 30 years and is one of the most popular meditation apps in the world, the Waking Up app. He is a straight-shooting, evangelical atheist neuroscientist who unapologetically defends the fact that there are subjective experiences that can appropriately be called spiritual, etc., and a trajectory of subjective development that can appropriately be called waking up, etc. If I come in with this book, people will see I'm framing this thing in a scientifically acceptable way. So I had your books, and I also had one called No Self, No Problem, How Neuropsychology is Catching Up with Buddhism, by Chris Niebauer, and also about a dozen articles about scientists studying the neurological mechanisms that go along with these types of experiences. Feeling well prepared, I carefully started making phone calls. I talked with a bunch of people who said they couldn't help, and on my dad's recommendation, I talked with my younger brother who said that he could help, that due to his own medical history, he knew some people I might be able to talk to, and then he filled out a form to have me taken in for an involuntary psychiatric checkup. The police came to my house while I was meditating with my buddy Dave. It was July 16th, a full week after the peak experience, or whatever. The cops said they pick people up on these sorts of calls a lot, and that I seemed fine, and that I shouldn't even bother packing a bag. They were kind and respectful, and didn't even put me in handcuffs like they were supposed to. They took me to the emergency psychiatric ward at Guelph General Hospital, which I later found out is run by a for-profit institution called Homewood Health Center. So this is what I want to talk with you about. JBT, in your book, you write, "I realized that morning that a hospital's number one responsibility should be protecting its patients' energy levels." Homewood did the opposite. I spent 5 years leading international trips all around Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Eastern Europe. Speaking as a pretty well-traveled human, this Schedule 1 mental health care facility stood out like a sore thumb. It was my least favorite place I've ever visited. What's happening in there doesn't fit with what's happening on the rest of planet Earth. Nowhere is normal, but there's a common humanity that pervades most social situations, and that humanity was nowhere to be found in the hospital. Treating people like that is inhumane and unscientific. Visiting the mental hospital was very, very bad for my mental health. When I got out, I discovered I'm not the first guy to have an issue like this. Here's a quote from Harvard professor Ram Dass's book, Be Here Now. "I've been with literally now well over 100 people who have had such an experience which was powerful and valid, but it was so discontinuous with their normal consciousness that they screamed for help. The help that was available to them was a group of minds which said, 'That's all right, you've just gone crazy. That experience you had is psychosis. I'll give you Thorazine. It's not valid. You're hallucinating.'" End quote. That's from 1971. I wasn't screaming for help. I was trying to help. And those doctors gave me Ativan, not Thorazine. But other than those differences, Professor Ram Dass pretty much perfectly described what happened to me. Now here's a passage from a book called The Stormy Search for the Self by a psychiatrist named Stan Grof. "Considering the positive nature and potential of peak experiences, it might seem puzzling that they can become a source of spiritual crisis. The main reason for such complications is a lack of real understanding about non-ordinary states of consciousness in Western culture. As a result, we are unable to recognize the value of such experiences, accept them, and support them. The prevailing attitude in traditional psychiatry, and among the general public, is that any deviations from the ordinary perception and understanding of reality are pathological. Many people in the midst of a peak experience have been sent to psychiatrists who gave them pathological labels, interrupted their experience with tranquilizing medication, and assigned them the role of lifelong psychiatric patients." End quote. That one's from 1990. I went way down the rabbit hole on this subject. In some ways, my story is typical, and in some ways, it's quite unique. And I feel it should be able to be helpful for that reason, but I don't know exactly how or what to do with it, so that's what I hope you can help me figure out. Here are the 9 reasons I think my story stands out. Number 1 is the most important, then the others are in no particular order. Number 1, I had your books with me in the hospital. If I can pat myself on the back for one thing, it's choosing Waking Up and My Stroke of Insight. I knocked it out of the park. I don't think I could have done any better. You two have so much cred. I didn't show up with Eckhart Tolle, Deepak Chopra, or Joel Osteen. I showed up with New York Times bestsellers by scientifically respected, world-famous authors who speak about these states from personal experience. I asked over and over and over again if I could show them the books I'd prepared to defend myself if I ended up in this exact situation, and they either flat out ignored me or said, "We don't go by that." The fact that I had your books with me is kind of a big deal. It changes the story from "the doctors misdiagnosed a spiritual experience" to "the doctors didn't acknowledge that world-famous neuroscientists have written books about and study spiritual experiences, did not acknowledge the fact that I repeatedly said that I had such books with me, and did not acknowledge the fact that they did not acknowledge any of that." It felt like being punished for a thought crime. It was, "You're crazy because you think these experiences exist." Was I acting a bit different than normal? Yeah, I was in an altered state in a very weird and uncomfortable situation. But any odd behavior was a distant second to me claiming that I had one of these things. It was a thought crime. So that's the main thing. This all happened while I had your books, plus Niebauer's book, plus like a dozen articles on non-dual states in my backpack. Number 2. The person who committed me has a lifelong history of psychological and behavioral issues. Of all the people I reached out to see about connecting with a neuroscientist, my brother is the only one who has been institutionalized, and unlike me, he agrees it was the right place for him to be. My brother never saw me during this time. He was in Toronto, 70 kilometers away. My dad, who was also in Toronto and hadn't seen me, told my brother not to commit me. My friend Jeff, who was with me in Guelph every day around this time, told my brother not to commit me. Maybe my brother was confused and delusional. Maybe he felt justified in making some stuff up to ensure they held me. But the information he put on the form was not true. And I'm not talking about like your truth versus my truth. I'm talking 2 plus 2 equals 4 versus 2 plus 2 equals 5. The biggest example of this is that he wrote on the form that I had previously admitted myself to CAMH, the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, a major mental health hospital in Toronto, for depression. This is demonstrably false. If this story ended up in court, CAMH couldn't produce a record of this because it never happened. Now it's almost 3 years later, and my brother still hasn't been able to have a real conversation about any of this. So yeah, my friends who were with me say I was okay. A doctor slash family friend I spoke with before the hospital said I seemed fine, the cops said I seemed fine, and my heavily medicated younger brother with a long history of psychological issues said I wasn't fine. This part's uncomfortable for me to talk about because I believe he meant well and intentions are a big part of morality, and I now understand more about his conditions and why he might act like that, so I don't want to throw him under the bus too much, but facts are facts. Number 3. I was released on what's called a religious exemption. After one night, a psychiatrist I hadn't met yet came to check on me, and before he could get started, I just told him, "Listen, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt because we haven't met, but here's what's up. I came in here trying to frame this thing in a scientific way, and nobody listened to me. I came in talking about gamma waves and endogenous DMT, not God or ghosts. None of your staff did anything but treat me like a lunatic from the moment I walked in here, so I've changed my mind. It wasn't neurological. It was religious. My brother doesn't like it. Too bad. Your hospital doesn't go by that. Too bad. We have freedom of religion in Canada. You're violating my religious rights, and I'm going to sue you, and I'm going to sue your entire hospital if you don't release me right now." He looked at my file for about 2 seconds, then said, "Okay, you can go." Number 4, follow up. I tried as hard as I could to follow up with the hospital, and they wouldn't budge. I kept sending them links to articles about scientists like you and about organizations working to help out with this problem, and they just kept saying, "We don't go by that. We don't go by that." One time I told the patient rep, "You know there's a standardized mystical experiences questionnaire used at Ivy League universities, and plenty of labs are studying the neurophenomenology associated with these states?" And she told me, "That's a religious belief." I also told her, "I came in feeling great and left feeling traumatized." And she told me, "We aren't concerned with the fact that you feel traumatized because that's your subjective opinion." Let that sink in for a second. We aren't concerned with the fact that you feel traumatized because that's your subjective opinion. A patient representative at a mental health hospital in Canada told me that in 2021. I have loads of emails showing how they just brushed me off and refused to take any responsibility. Number 5. I claim that I triggered this experience primarily through an intellectual understanding that there's no solid unified self. This is way more than I can explain here, but meditators say that a deep realization of no self is one of 3 doors to trigger these sorts of things, and I think I thought my way there, and that's kind of cool. Number 6. Brain smarts. 2 days after I got out of the hospital, I had an appointment with an ADD specialist. She asked me what I know about ADD. I said, blah, blah, blah. And she said, "Whoa, when did you learn that?" I said, 3 weeks ago. And she said, "You're basically talking about neuropsychology on a professional level. I think you might be a genius." A week later, I met another ADD specialist, and she said the same thing. Now, I don't know if they're right, but they did say that. Obviously, that's not such a chill thing to say, but it feels relevant. And mostly because of the timing. The doctors in the hospital who don't acknowledge that you two exist, Sam Harris and Jill Bolt Taylor, and who aren't concerned with the fact that I felt traumatized, said that I lack insight. And then right after that, ADD specialists said I speak about my nervous system so articulately that they think I might be a genius. I don't know what to do with that, but it seems relevant. Also, I said I triggered it from an intellectual understanding, so yeah. By the way, I don't feel like a genius. If I am, you two are like triple platinum geniuses, because I can tell from far away that you are a lot smarter than me. Number 7, lack of shame. The second ADD specialist and several therapists after that have told me I have an unusual lack of shame regarding psychiatric diagnoses. I'm not brave, I just literally don't feel shame about them. I think there are two reasons for this. One is that learning about ADD was such a profound and beneficial experience, and now I want to know what's up with me, through any model. It's like checking my credit card statement. I might not like what I see, but it's better to know what's up than not to know. So the folks in the hospital said I had a manic episode, and that means that I am bipolar, or I have bipolar disorder, I'm living with bipolar, something like that. I was definitely keyed up, and I understand how that could have looked like a manic episode, especially with an ADD baseline, but it's been nearly 3 years and I don't feel bipolar. I read all about it. I listened to the podcasts. I gave it honest consideration, and I just don't feel like that diagnosis applies to me. I don't laugh at the memes like I do with ADD. The other reason, if I zoom a layer out, is that I don't take mainstream psychiatric diagnoses very seriously. I know that's going to ruffle some feathers, so I'll just keep it between us. And I know obviously I'm a bit biased having lived through what I did, but I'm learning about psychology from Gabor Mate, Bessel van der Kolk, and Lisa Feldman Barrett. You know what I mean? Mainstream psychiatry and the DSM just seems so dated. We know about epigenetics and gut health and the vagal nerve and neuroplasticity now, not to mention brain scans that can measure so-called spiritual experiences. Anyway, it doesn't matter if I'm right or wrong about psychiatry. The relevant factor is that, through whatever lens, I don't feel shame about diagnoses. This shame thing is relevant because one of the main assumptions I run into is you're denying you had a psychotic break because you're ashamed. And that's just not true. If I had a psychotic break, I'd own it. I have lots of new friends now who said they had some sort of break and got mistreated. My claim is that I was sane, lucid, and fully functional, and I still got treated like that. Number 8, no dangerous behavior. Like I said, I was altered and different than normal, but there's no specific behavior anybody can point to as being dangerous or dysfunctional. I didn't have any thoughts of hurting myself or anybody else. I didn't threaten anyone. I wasn't out of control in any way. I was sleeping. I was eating. The most dangerous, irresponsible thing I did was to make a phone call to the US that cost $120. My friend had a short window to talk. We couldn't get Zoom to work, so I called her. I figured it would be about $50 or $60. It was twice that, and, you know, that it was less than the cost of a therapy appointment, so whatever. My hospital report says I was friendly, calm, and made good eye contact, but I still got increased to a 3-day hold, and I think it's because I insisted I had one of these spiritual experiences. Number 9, language and ineffability. Here's my wild card, you guys. To me, this mostly looks like a language issue. I think a major reason this problem exists is that we're not considering how language functions across developmental thresholds. I think most people who end up hospitalized for these things try to talk about their realizations and insights, but I didn't do that. I just said, I'm having one of those experiences Sam Harris and Jill Bolt Taylor talk about. That's quite different. I think what my case shows is that we're dealing with subjective experiences that are so ineffable, you can't even convince people they exist. Sam, in waking up, you say, before going any further, I should address the animosity that many readers feel toward the term spiritual. Whenever I use the word, as in referring to meditation as a spiritual practice, I hear from fellow skeptics and atheists who think I've committed a grievous error. End quote. I think it's more than animosity, Sam. I think it's a processing problem, like a neurolinguistic block. This is more than I can explain in one letter, but to me, a lot of insight, at least at my level, feels like the poetry of neuroscience. So what I'm wondering is, are there neurolinguistic mechanisms associated with the saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink? Like, why can't I explain that these experiences exist? Really, this should be simple. Taking drugs gets you high, having sex leads to orgasms, doing spiritual practice leads to spiritual experiences. At the level relevant to this hospital issue, these are just subjective states. You can't know what being drunk feels like until you drink alcohol, and you can't know what these feel like until you've had one. Why is this so difficult? Tour guiding was all about vibe control and communication, and before that, I was a face-to-face charity fundraiser. I don't know about this whole genius thing, but I am professionally friendly. I am trained to be charming. I can stop people in the street and convince them to give $60 a month to a charity they never heard of before they met me. But I can't explain that whatever happened to me was enjoyable and psychologically beneficial when it was so clearly enjoyable and psychologically beneficial. People say these states are ineffable, but so ineffable I can't even convince some of my best friends and family members and university-educated doctors that they exist? Not even with waking up and my stroke of insight? Not even with all the studies on meditators? Not even with William James and Willoughby Britton? Not even when the stakes are involuntary commitment and drugging? Did anybody ever point out that that doesn't make any sense? It almost feels magical, and everybody just seems to accept it and be smart enough to know that you don't try to report these things. But I'm, like, so ineffable I can't explain they exist? What? That's ridiculous. Why is this harder to explain than synesthesia or deja vu? So, I dove into neurolinguistics and paid a lot of attention to this, and what I've experienced is that talking about psychology or spirituality to people who aren't into those subjects feel the same if you ignore the words. Do you see what I'm saying? The valence switches. On the other side of the looking glass, words like awakening sounded cheesy. Now they sound good. Poetically, it's like our brains don't let us hear what our hearts aren't ready for. But it's more of a vagal state trauma response thing where our brains moderate our ability to comprehend language just below our perceptual awareness. It's like very subtle triggers, but the sense of self persists, so people don't get that they're missing something. Anyway, I need some help unpacking this because I'm just some dude, and I don't like credentialism, but I respect credentials and the scientific method, and even though I really feel like I can see the code on this one, metaphorically, I know we need some proper scientific experiments. I have them all set up in my head, I just need a little help getting it on paper. So yeah, those are my 9 standouts. It's pretty awkward to talk about a lot of this, but I'm doing it because I'm very concerned about this issue. I'm concerned about iatrogenesis, which means harm caused by doctors, and I'm concerned about the impunity. Nobody's holding these folks accountable. I'm not exaggerating in the slightest when I said it felt more like torture than medicine. It really broke my heart to find out that that's how we treat people. Also, I am struck by the absurdity that this is even an issue. I only tried meditating because neuroscientists told me it would be good for my brain. When I survey the landscape, I see meditating scientists saying, "This stuff is powerful, and you need to make sure to take care of your normal psychology." But the mainstream mental health hospitals, at least the one I went to, are saying, "Mindfulness is good for you, so meditate. But spiritual experiences don't exist, and if you think they do, you are crazy." Maybe one of the reasons this is still an issue is that academics have social and professional restrictions that make it hard for them to call this issue out for what it is, but I'm just some dude, so I guess I'll say it. I don't want to be rude. I appreciate these doctors are trying to do good, but the word for what's happening here is dumb. This is so dumb. We can see that long-term meditators' brains look healthier and are more functional. Long-term meditators say sometimes these spiritual experiences happen. We can see monks' brains doing all sorts of weird stuff that looks neurologically like way happier than most people ever feel. And then my mainstream hospital is like, "Oh, we don't go by that." What? All right, this is definitely a societally approved human rights violation, like slavery was, like calling homosexuality a mental disorder was, and it's a complex systemic issue and it's a tragedy, but also, this is dumb. This is so dumb. If Homewood is representative of the status quo, mainstream psychiatry is literally pathologizing joy and healing. Sam Harris, Jill Bolt Taylor, I'm really upset by what I saw in there and I want to help out. Einstein said imagination is everything. It is the preview of life's coming attractions. So, I'm going to try to use my imagination to dream up a medical system with a more nuanced understanding of these sorts of experiences. But I don't think my imagination is that strong yet, so I kind of got to flex it and work it out like a muscle. So, let's see what I can do. Sam Harris, Jill Bolt Taylor, I sincerely imagine that you two will talk with me and help me figure out what to do with this story, because you are actual scientists and I am just some dude from Canada. My email is danglantern@gmail.com. Thank you so much. I look forward to speaking with you. Love, Dan.